Welcome to this special episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. For Women's History Month, I could think of no better way of wrapping up our celebration than with one of my favorite historians, Dr. Nicola Tallis, speaking about one of my favorite women in history, Queen Elizabeth I. Not her time as queen, but Nicola's book, Young Elizabeth, How She Became the Queen. And I'm thrilled that she was willing to join us. So sit back and enjoy this conversation with Nicola Tallis. Welcome, everyone. I have such a special treat for you. I am here with Nicola Tallis and her latest book, Young Elizabeth. You can see a number of books behind me. And look, something exciting. I have more than one on my Kindle, and I've realized how I could just show one at a time, but I can't go back and forth. Since we're talking about Elizabeth, in addition to a marvelous book about Elizabeth's rival and also Jane Grey, which was on the screen a moment ago, Uncrowned Queen, which is marvelous, and the book about the jewels, which is so wonderful, and then this latest, Young Elizabeth. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you mentioned once that you were a little hesitant to write specifically about Elizabeth because so much has been done about her. So tell us a little bit about that and how you decided to write this book.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I have been terrified about writing Elizabeth pretty much the whole of my career because, like you said, she is somebody who is so well known to so many people. And she's someone who I feel really invokes strong feelings. People either kind of revere her as being a really great queen or feel that perhaps she's a bit overrated. And I think for a long time, I felt that I perhaps didn't really have anything to contribute to the debate. And for me, if I'm going to write something, then I want to have something new to say and something different to say. And I was actually commissioned originally to write a full biography of Elizabeth. Utterly terrifying, I have to say. and then it just didn't work out. It's weird. It's the first book that I've done where I just kind of got into it and found that it just wasn't working, wasn't coming together. I felt like all I was doing was really repeating what had already been put out there about Elizabeth. And to me, it seemed like the part of the story that I was most interested in was the part where she is a little girl, a teenager, and a young woman facing an uncertain future. And to me, yes, that story has been told more than 20 years ago now by David Starkey, but it felt like there was a new and kind of fresh perspective just waiting to be told on that. And I was really, really excited to have the opportunity to tell that story. Luckily, my editor agreed when I went and said, yeah, the full biography of Elizabeth, it's not working. Can I just do Young Elizabeth instead? And she was like, yeah, absolutely. Sounds great. So I was really lucky because it gave me, the room to expand on some of that. And and Young Elizabeth came into being and I'm so grateful for that. I think it worked out really, really well.
Oh, that is great to hear. Now, when you think about Elizabeth, we know a lot about her as queen and the length of her reign, the longest reigning Tudor and all of that. And I think sometimes we forget just how uncertain her future was because we're looking backward and it seems inevitable that she came to the throne. Of course she came to the throne, but it was so not inevitable. So how did you find, she was out of favor after Anne Boleyn was executed. She just was on the sidelines for a long time. How did you find information about her as a child and as a teenager when she was out of favor and maybe not part of some of the official records?
Yeah, I mean, that was a challenge. But I think that I was quite lucky, or we are quite lucky, I should say, that there are actually quite a lot of Elizabeth's letters that survive pre-queenship. A lot of them that come from the reign of her half-brother, Edward VI, and for various reasons, including when, you know, she gets caught up in the scandal with Thomas Seymour. There's an awful lot of letters then. But, you know, also more mundane letters, I suppose we could say, in some respects, as to how she conducted her business affairs and how she managed her estates, those sorts of things. And some of those, I think, have been a little bit overlooked. But there is information there if you look for it. And when you combine that with, yes, perhaps the occasional reference to, oh, Lady Elizabeth was at court today, there is quite a lot to help you sort of pin together this strong narrative. But I think most crucially, yeah, it was very fortunate that there are so many letters of Elizabeth so that we can tell her story in her own words. And that was a huge, huge privilege and a huge delight to be able to read her letters and tell her story from her point of view, because that's ultimately what we all want to do. We all want those letters. We all want that first person speaking to us. So very, very lucky that was the case.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. And of course, you know, it's really interesting. We could have a whole discussion about Henry VIII as a father, but even though he declares both of his daughters illegitimate and never backs off that view, he never denies that he's the father or has any question about that. So she was always recognized as the king's daughter, although her mother's marriage was wiped out and her mother was wiped out. So that gives her really an interesting and unique perspective. So I wanted to ask about some of the relationships that she had. And you mentioned some references, and even early on, when she's placed in the care of Lady Bryan, and then after Edward comes along and in the care of Lady Troy, and we have Catherine Chaperon joining her, of course, becomes Ashley or Astley. So tell us about some of those early relationships with, she calls her bringers up, or those who bring her up with her mother gone, and she doesn't make it quite that direct, but some of those people who were very involved in her early life.
Yeah, and those relationships are hugely important to Elizabeth, because as we know, it isn't standard for royal children to be raised by their parents as such. Nobody would have expected Henry VIII or Anne Boleyn to be playing a hands-on role and, you know, I don't know, changing nappies and all these sorts of, it just wasn't the done thing. So these women and these people who surround Elizabeth during her youth are basically an extension of her family. They're the closest people to her. They're the people that know Elizabeth the person, or Elizabeth the little girl, as well as Elizabeth the political player in, you know, her father's plans, her brother's plans. And they're among the few people who know her intimately well. And as you say, there's Lady Bryan, there's Lady Troy, and there's Kate, Astley, as I call her. And those women are really key. And we know more about the relationship that Elizabeth has with Kate than with the other two. But to all intents and purposes, what little we do know of the relationships with Bryan and Troy suggests that Elizabeth was quite fond of them. We know that she's paying Lady Troy a pension well into the 1550s after Lady Troy has left her service. But it is, of course, Kate who has gone down in Elizabeth's history as being the one who was really, really close to her. And I think that what's quite touching is that we can learn quite a lot about Elizabeth from looking at these relationships as well, because what we can see is that Elizabeth was fiercely, fiercely loyal towards those who were in her inner circle. And it's like, once you made it into that inner circle, that's it. You're in it for life. And what I find really, really interesting is during those dark days in the aftermath of the Seymour scandal during Edward's reign, when Kate is taken to the Tower and questioned over her involvement in Seymour, with what's going on with Seymour, and she does eventually confess, who can blame her? She's kept in pretty stringent conditions. But Elizabeth never holds this against her, and she never ever blames Kate really for what's gone on. She's always really loyal to her, and I think that that's a real mark of Elizabeth's character as well. And I feel like it's something that comes about as a result of her upbringing and is just a real sign that she needs these people. She wants them to be close to her. She trusts them, and she is never ever going to let them down and betray them. And I think that it's something that perhaps isn't talked about enough in Elizabeth's case, just how much these relationships matter to her, and yeah, how what they tell us about her as a person.
Right. And you mentioned that time when she is in danger after the Seymour thing. She really is being interrogated, and they're determined to find something against her. And even in the midst of that, I love that letter she writes to Somerset advocating for Kate Astley and for others that have served her, but specifically for Kate. And really, she's in a vulnerable position herself, but that is a strong letter advocating for somebody else who's in the tower being questioned. I mean, she doesn't hesitate to put herself on the line. And I find that really interesting and tells me something about Elizabeth, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it does most definitely say a great deal about Elizabeth, the fact that, as you say, she's having a difficult time of it herself at the moment. And also, with Kate gone, she's left with Sir Robert Tyrwhitt's wife, a woman who's not particularly fond of her, who she's not particularly fond of, who, you know, is far more serious in character than Kate is. And so Elizabeth's really just left to her own devices. She's got only herself to rely on, with nobody really to speak to or advise her. And the fact that she is willing to put herself out there for Kate and really kind of push Somerset on Kate's behalf, mm-hmm. I think it's really quite heartwarming and does just show how much of an impact Kate had made on Elizabeth's life in a positive way.
Yeah. And how Elizabeth, like you say, once you're in the inner circle, she is devoted to you as well. She's as loyal as Kate is to her. She's as loyal to Kate, which I think is great. Now, this time period, which is during the reign of her brother. So I wonder if we can shift just a little and talk about her relationship with Edward. Because when they were younger, they were 4 years apart and spent time together and seemed quite close. And when he comes to the throne, they share the religion. And so that's another reason. In fact, when he learns he's king, Seymour brings them together to tell them that Henry VIII has died and Edward's now king. So there's a thought that these two are going to be, you know, close to each other, able to comfort each other or whatever. You want them together. So what does, do we have any indication Edward's concerned about her when all of this is going on during his reign?
In a word, no. We don't know. And that's not to say that he's not. It's just to say that we just don't have any evidence of what was going on. And I think maybe at that time, I don't know. I think obviously Somerset is very much at the fore of what's going on. He's very much in charge. I think Edward doesn't really have much of a voice at this time as well. So I think, I mean, I'm sure he probably, Edward must have been concerned about his sister. But we don't know anything. There's just nothing that we can surmise because we just don't have anything, sadly. But I think, I mean, I find it hard to believe that he would have allowed Elizabeth to be punished had there been any evidence that Elizabeth had been conspiring with Seymour, because I think, as you say, they're really, really fond of one another. And even though the nature of that relationship changes when Edward becomes king, because they're not spending as much time together anymore, I think that it's clear that Edward's still very, very fond of Elizabeth. And we see this later in the reign. I think, yeah, just at this point, perhaps he is kind of just taking a bit more of a back seat in affairs and doing very much as his uncle tells him to.
Right, because he is still young at that time.
Yeah, very young.
And he may think that, well, she can probably handle it. He knows her pretty well. And well, it turns out he's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But you mentioned she is back in favor later in his reign. And so this is not like he is forever suspicious of her or anything like that.
No, they're so fond of each other. And you can see it's a really touching relationship, actually, I think, with Elizabeth and Edward, because there's so much in common between them. I mean, obviously, they've both lost their mothers in tragic circumstances. Both have never really had an opportunity to know their mothers and spent a lot of time together when they're very young. And then, of course, they are bonded by religion. And that is something that definitely sets them apart from their sister Mary, which becomes yes. apparent as Edward's reign progresses. But I think, you know, the fact that they were so close in age and that they were the only two, you know, the only two of, you know, of comparatively close status, I think serves to really bond them further as well. And we know, for example, that Elizabeth was visiting Edward at court later in his reign. And on one occasion, they attended a bear baiting together. They both seem to have quite liked blood sports. They do seem to have been very, very fond of one another. So I think also Elizabeth's quite eager to identify herself with Edward, because she does begin styling herself as the king's sister. And so I think that that is something that matters a great deal to her, that relationship with Edward on a political as well as a personal level. So it's really important to her that she stays on good terms with him. And I think he, in turn, was very happy to have her by his side.
Right. And supporting him in his religious reforms, which she did. So I often, you know, speak for the Smithsonian and other places here in the States about the Tudors. And one of the questions I'm often asked is, when we come to the moment where Edward decides to create his device for the succession, why does he not leave the throne to Elizabeth? He trusts her with the religion. They have this relationship. Why does he not make that choice? Now, there are a lot of reasons, but I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, because given that close relationship you've described and how she has been there for him, how does he decide to disinherit her?
I don't think that there is really any choice, because I think as soon as Edward decides that he wants to remove Mary, there's no way that he can do that without removing Elizabeth as well. There's just no way, because the way that Mary is removed is based on her illegitimacy, which, as you say, Henry VIII never made any move to restore either of his daughters' legitimacy. And if he's going to remove Mary on those grounds, then he has to do exactly the same to Elizabeth. And so it's not a personal decision. I'm pretty sure it would have been quite a difficult decision for Edward to make in some respects, but it's clear that it's the future of Protestantism that matters mm-hmm. the most to him. And so all family loyalties have to be put to one side. And I think it's as simple as that in Edward's mind. That's the only way that it's going to work for him. And so desperate is he to avoid Mary succeeding that Elizabeth has to be sacrificed as part of that process.
Right. I think that's really important to see, you know, his priority there. And also, sometimes there's an attitude that he was sort of cavalier about changing the succession. And in fact, it's very methodical. Going back to the issue of legitimacy, it was against the law for an illegitimate child to inherit. So he really did base that device on something very concrete. But as you say, Elizabeth had to be sacrificed as part of it. Yeah. All right. So I want to turn to another. So a couple more relationships, just because I think relationships are so telling. Before we completely leave Edward's reign, I want to talk about Catherine Parr, because she was a really important person in Elizabeth's life. We talked a little bit about the Seymour. We sort of talked around it. But right at the heart of that whole issue is Catherine Parr. And when she marries Henry VIII, and Elizabeth did attend that wedding, and Catherine Parr was already known as a great stepmother of her other husband's children. So this looked to be wonderful. And as a stepmother, she was wonderful. So talk to us about that relationship, which is so important to Elizabeth in a lot of ways and also becomes really complicated.
Yeah, as you say, it is a really, really important relationship to Elizabeth. And it's very, very clear that she absolutely adores Catherine. And I mean, who can blame her at this point? Because Catherine comes into Elizabeth's life. And at this point, Elizabeth's gained and lost three stepmothers in very, very quick succession, in difficult circumstances in most of those instances. And I think she was really craving a bit of family stability. And that's something that Catherine really offers her, and, you know, welcomes all these children into the fold of her family. As you say, she's already got a great track record as a stepmother to her second husband's two children, Margaret and John. And I think that it was very natural for her to try and bring Elizabeth into that as well. And yeah, Elizabeth's hugely receptive to that. She, I think, particularly enjoys spending time with Catherine during the summer of 1544, when Catherine is regent of England whilst Henry VIII is invading France. I genuinely think that that's probably the happiest summer of Elizabeth's childhood. Watching Catherine take a very hands-on approach to government, but also enjoying some fun times together. We know that they go hunting together at Woking, Catherine and all of the royal children, and we know that they're together at Eltham. So it really is kind of like a great big family holiday. And we know that Catherine takes a huge interest in Elizabeth's development, that they've got scholarly interests in common. We don't quite know how or what part Catherine played in the education of Elizabeth and Edward, but I definitely think that she may have had some influence when it came to choosing Elizabeth's first tutor, William Grindal. So I think that it's clear that she does recognise Elizabeth's academic talents and wants to really nurture those. So they've got quite a lot in common anyway, and they get along really, really well together. Certainly during the later part of Henry VIII's reign, Elizabeth is at court a lot more frequently. And we see, you know, there are appearances that Elizabeth makes in Catherine's account books as well, you know, where she's sending, on one occasion, she sends her stepdaughter Margaret Neville off to Ashridge to presumably deliver messages. And it's quite touching, I think. So they do seem to stay in touch. They do seem to be very fond of one another. And so when Henry VIII dies and Elizabeth is offered a home with Catherine Parr, I think Elizabeth must have been absolutely elated at this opportunity to live with Catherine full time. I think that she must have been thrilled that her stepmother wanted her there with her, and presumably just envisioned life continuing very much as it had done. And of course, that doesn't quite play out. Thomas Seymour arrives on the scene before long, and that's when the relationship does, as you say, take a very complicated turn.
Yes, and there are different ways of looking at Catherine's role as Thomas Seymour takes some actions that many of us find a little objectionable with a stepdaughter, especially a young stepdaughter. Although we can't necessarily impose modern sensibilities, but still, when you're married and your wife is pregnant, there are behaviors that seem in any day to be inappropriate. So talk to us about Elizabeth's experiences there and how confusing and overwhelming and troubling that must have been for her. As you say, she thought it was going to be this sort of idyllic, full-time fun with Catherine Parr. Not that that meant no work. She was an eager student, and I'm sure planned to be an eager student still.
Yeah.
But didn't expect the complications.
No, exactly. And I think the complications start, according to Kate Astley anyway, almost immediately after Thomas moves in with Catherine and Elizabeth, who are then living at the manor house at Chelsea in London. And, you know, according to the depositions of Kate Astley and Thomas Parry, Elizabeth's cofferer, basically very soon after Thomas's arrival, he begins paying Elizabeth visits in her chamber first thing in the morning, sometimes before she's risen. Sometimes he would just poke his head around the door and bid her good morning. Other times he would come in and strike her upon the back and the buttocks, we're told. And I think to begin with, Elizabeth was flattered by these attentions because Thomas was handsome. He was charming. He, you know, he had the gift of the gab. He, to all intents and purposes, you know, seemed very friendly, but was also very, very arrogant, reckless, ruthless, ambitious. And I think Elizabeth was completely thrown by this because to begin with, she does seem to have harbored like a teenage crush. But it didn't take long for her to become alarmed by Thomas's behavior. And Kate Astley becomes alarmed as well. And given that, you know, Kate's a bit of a gossip and she's also someone who seems a bit less serious than Elizabeth, let's just say. So when Kate Astley becomes alarmed, you know that something's not quite right. And Kate approaches Thomas, asking him to mind his behavior. And he basically, he doesn't take kindly to this warning at all and refuses to curb his behavior. And the morning visits continue. By now, there is gossip within the household as to what's going on. And I find it impossible to believe that Catherine wouldn't have come to learn of this gossip in one way, shape, or form. And she does, to begin with, seem to turn a blind eye to Thomas's behavior. And it's really difficult to rationalize or to try and find some kind of explanation for this because Catherine doesn't come out of this particularly well. I'm a huge fan of Catherine Parr's, but I have to say that, yeah, in this instance, she doesn't come out looking good. And I think the only explanation that I can think of is that she is blinded by Thomas's charms. We talked about the fact that he is charming, that he tells her everything she wants to hear. But I also think she's a bit intimidated by him as well. And I think that she starts joining in with these morning visits as well and on other occasions. But it's not long after that happens that matters take another turn. And Catherine apparently walks in on Thomas and Elizabeth, and she has her arms about his neck. Now, we don't know how that came to be because although Elizabeth had harbored this teenage crush, she had also become alarmed by Thomas's behavior and done her best to avoid him. So I don't know. We don't know how that came into being, but it must have been hugely confusing for Elizabeth, who is barely a teenager at this point. And it's her first kind of experience with a man on a romantic level and a man who's, you know, several decades older than her. So I think it must have left her hugely confused, but I think she must have realized that it was also inappropriate.
Right. And then she's sent, after that incident, when Catherine Parr finds them, Elizabeth is sent out of the household. And there's a letter she writes to Catherine Parr, which to me does sound like sort of a timeless teenage letter where she's apologizing in some ways and saying, I know I didn't seem to be paying attention and listening to what you were saying, but I was, which to me sounds very much like a teenager would say. So what does that letter tell you about Elizabeth's feelings toward Catherine and recognition or understanding of the seriousness of what this could represent for her?
I think basically when Elizabeth leaves Catherine's household and has a bit of time to reflect on that, she recognizes how deeply she had hurt Catherine and also the way that, like you said, she says about the fact that basically she hadn't really paid much attention to what Catherine was saying at the time. But I think she goes away and thinks about that and recognizes that actually maybe stepmom does have my best intentions at heart. And I think that this is her roundabout way of trying to apologize for that and trying to say to her, yeah, okay, I know I didn't take it too seriously at the time, but I get where you're coming from now. So I think it's quite a reflective letter on Elizabeth's part. And yeah, her recognizing that the love and care that Catherine has for her. And it's, it's Elizabeth, I think, making an attempt to try and repair that relationship. Because although we know that that relationship, you know, seemingly had begun to heal by the time Elizabeth had left, I think it would be foolish to think that it was everything was fine and, you know, beds of roses by the time that Elizabeth left. How could it be? But I think that that is Elizabeth acknowledging that that relationship is really, really important to her, and it's not one that she wants to lose by any means.
Right. And so there's that first really significant letter, but there are some other letters from Elizabeth to Catherine that are maybe more chatty and talk about the baby. And so she does seem really interested in wanting to be a part of things. Unfortunately, they are never able to be in person together again because Catherine dies right after having the baby in childbirth, as many do. And I know that must have been pretty significant for Elizabeth, both on a personal, just this woman in particular, but also the ongoing fears about childbirth. And, you know, even people at the, you know, part of society where you would think they had everything they needed, that doesn't necessarily matter in that moment. So I want to just move to one final and really complicated relationship, probably the most complicated and in some ways longest is, a complicated long one is with her sister, Mary.
Yeah. Hugely complicated relationship.
Right from the start, because Elizabeth's existence is the reason that Mary's life is so difficult in those moments. Yeah. And yet Mary really tries for a period of time to be a nurturing, almost mother-like figure to Elizabeth. So tell us about how that relationship evolves and changes and is so important. I think it's so important to Elizabeth. It's important to both of them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that for a long time, there's been a tendency to not necessarily pit them against one another, but it's kind of like you like Elizabeth or you like Mary. You can't like both. Whereas actually, I genuinely feel like, sadly, in the 21st century, it's probably a relationship that on some levels, lots of people can identify with, you know, in terms of family rifts. I hear of people all the time who sadly don't speak to family members anymore. And it just kind of reminds you that this is something that's been going on for centuries and centuries. And I think that I genuinely feel like this is one of the greatest tragedies of both of their lives, because as you say, the Elizabeth's birth is a reason for hostility on Mary's part. And it's something that for a while, it seems like Mary can get past, but then actually she can't get past it. And it's actually nothing to do with Elizabeth. It's all to do with Elizabeth's mother, Anne Boleyn, and Henry's separation from Mary's mother, Catherine of Aragon. And it's really tragic. And I think, Mary does try very hard. As soon as Anne Boleyn is out of the way, she does take on this maternal role, like you said. And we see these really touching glimpses of their relationship in Mary's account books, where we can see that Mary's buying Elizabeth presents and she's engaging with Elizabeth's servants in her household. So it looks to all intents and purposes like that relationship can heal or, you know, can flourish. And it does flourish for quite a while. And it's only really in the reign of their brother Edward that things seem to kind of cool a little bit. And although we have got one letter from Elizabeth that survives to Mary, which was written during Edward's reign, and it talks about the fact that the sisters are in frequent communication. So although they don't seem to spend a lot of time together, apparently they are writing to one another. And I think, you know, this was a classic case of Elizabeth getting older. She's getting more strong-willed, perhaps being a bit of an annoying teenager in some respects. I can see that quite easily. And of course, they're divided by religion, which is a huge sticking point. But I think Mary is so naturally warm-hearted and so desperately wants this relationship to work. And we see immediately after Mary's accession that when she arrives in London to take possession of her capital city, Elizabeth's there by her side and Mary's very, very happy to have her there. And for the first couple of months of her reign, she keeps Elizabeth close to her. She showers her with gifts. Elizabeth's treated really well. But I think, unfortunately, this is also a classic case of outside influences. And, you know, we see that all too clearly where Elizabeth is, of course, her sister's heir when Mary becomes queen. She's younger than Mary. She's on the opposite side of the religious spectrum to Mary. And so that immediately sets her up as a figurehead for those who are opposed to Mary. And it doesn't take long for Elizabeth's enemies, chiefly in the form of the Spanish ambassadors, to start drip feeding Mary poison about Elizabeth and saying, your sister's plotting against you. And I think, unfortunately, it doesn't take long for that to really get into Mary's head. And I think that it is hugely tragic and a massive shame, because it does seem like something changes very soon after Mary becomes queen, and that relationship, which, although built on bitter foundations, had flourished, it seems like it's all about to come crashing down. And I think it really is so desperately sad for both of them.
Yes. And eventually the Wyatt Rebellion happens, related to Mary's choice of marrying Philip of Spain. And Elizabeth, again, finds herself under interrogation, this time in the Tower, having to rely on her wits to sort of know how to answer these questions. Wyatt himself exonerates right up to the time he's executed, says that it is not, you know, Elizabeth was not guilty, which is in those days a very powerful kind of thing to do. But Mary is encouraged to keep Elizabeth in the Tower. And some of those advisors you mentioned, unfortunately, those other people really were trying to get Mary to lean into having Elizabeth executed. Do you think Mary ever really entertained that idea? Or do you think, when there wasn't any evidence, Mary always intended to release her on May 19th, which seems impossible not to have been a deliberate choice, but that she really was always planning to release her?
I think Mary was quite uncertain for quite a while, because let's not forget, she has reluctantly executed Lady Jane Grey, their cousin, very, very shortly before Elizabeth entered the Tower. And it is clear that that decision is made with a great deal of reluctance, and because she felt that she had no other choice. And I think that had there been evidence that Elizabeth had been plotting against Mary, perhaps Mary would have, I don't think that she would ultimately have had her executed, but I think that, I think even if she had, it would have been a decision that was made with great reluctance. She knew that Elizabeth was very, very popular as well. But yeah, I definitely think that that being released on the 19th of May was a very, very deliberate irony, and almost like a warning, actually, in some ways. I think Mary was genuinely convinced that Elizabeth had been plotting against her. And my own feeling is that I don't think that Elizabeth had been involved in directly plotting against her. I think that she knew what was going on, but that she hadn't revealed that to Mary. And I think that in Mary's eyes, that's tantamount to the same thing, really. It still means you've been plotting against her. And I think Mary felt hugely, hugely hurt and betrayed. And I think that sending Elizabeth to the Tower was ultimately an attempt to try and frighten her, which it obviously did. And I think, yes, ultimately, I think it's unclear. I think it's very unclear what Mary intends to do, because it doesn't take long for it to become obvious that there isn't going to be any evidence forthcoming against Elizabeth. Because as you say, Wyatt never incriminates her, neither do any of the other conspirators. So it becomes clear that something has to be done. But Mary's still convinced that Elizabeth is guilty of plotting against her and knows that some solution has to be found, but just doesn't quite know what that is. And I think that she saw, ultimately felt that setting Elizabeth at her liberty wasn't an option, but putting her under house imprisonment was probably the next best thing. So it's tricky to know what Mary's real intentions were in that situation, because I feel ultimately that she was just feeling very hurt and very angry and betrayed. And who can blame her? I don't think, even though we don't know the extent of Elizabeth's involvement in the plot, I think that you have to feel sympathy for Mary on that level, in terms of, you know, she's shown her sister so much kindness. And from her perspective, she genuinely believes that Elizabeth's thrown it all in her face. So, yeah, I feel like that's just a reaction, you know, throwing Elizabeth into the tower, a very hurtful reaction that she knows is going to terrify Elizabeth. But I think it's a reaction to feeling hurt on a personal level.
Right. And I just feel like, you know, what must Elizabeth have felt on, and if you don't know, May 19th is the anniversary of Anne Boleyn's execution. I should say that, not just assume everybody knows, but imagine being Elizabeth, knowing is the anniversary of your mother's execution, and hearing the guards, you know, at the tower coming for you and not really knowing. That moment must have been really scary, which Mary, on a personal level, may have thought, you need to be that scared to know that I'm the queen. And so, do you see Philip as playing a role? Because there are other times that it appears that Philip intervenes when Mary is considering naming someone else as her heir. Because like Edward, Mary doesn't want all the religious work to be undone. She is trying her best to have a child, but that hasn't happened yet. And so Mary seems interested in finding someone else. Do you think Philip does indeed play a role there?
Yeah, I think Philip's very keen to be seen as the mediator as well, most definitely. But let's not forget that Philip's got his own agenda as well. And Philip's support doesn't come for free. So yes, he does help to secure Elizabeth's liberty, and he does advise caution where Elizabeth is concerned to his wife, Mary. But yeah, this is all very much done with his own interests in mind, because we know that he wants to marry Elizabeth off to one of his supporters, Emmanuel Philibert, Duke of Savoy, and Elizabeth refuses to have anything to do with this match whatsoever. And he also, Philip recognises that whilst Mary is childless, regardless of what Mary feels about the situation, really all of her counsellors and all of her people are in favour of Elizabeth succeeding. And so he recognizes that it's politics to stay in Elizabeth's good books as well. So Philip most definitely does play a role. He calms Mary as best as he can. But yeah, it's very much done for his own reasons and not out of the goodness of his heart.
Right. And he does try and sort of trade on that later after Elizabeth becomes queen and says it's because of him.
Oh, he absolutely does. Yeah, he really does. And Elizabeth's not having any of that. It's nothing to do with Philip.
But it's great to see that clear. I mean, he's not making any mystery that he's claiming credit, and nor does she pull any punches saying, not yours, not your victory, dude. So it's pretty amazing. So all of this happens, and then something so unexpected happens, and your book ends with, and again, I'll just hold it up.
Yes, thank you.
This way, you can see all my marks, but already, I've only read it once, so there will be more. But Elizabeth does come to the throne and has this amazing coronation, wearing Mary's coronation robes, which is really interesting. But I find that at this moment, these sisters who have been separated, really, they are the first two crowned regnant queens. And this is the only time in English or British history that the throne has passed from one regnant queen to another regnant queen, which I think is quite remarkable. And then they do end up buried at Westminster, eventually in the same place. And there's a note there, or a plaque there, about two sisters together. So when Elizabeth comes to the throne, it's such, we think of it now as inevitable, but it is really unlikely. I mean, it, of course, as Mary's getting older, it becomes more clear it's going to happen. But it was unexpected from the time, well, really from the time she was born, because at that point it was expected Anne Boleyn would have a son. And then after Anne Boleyn's gone, it's never thought she would come to the throne. So do you think Elizabeth realized, from all the people she knew and people who knew her mother, and Tracy Borman spends a lot of time with that in her book as well, do you think she realized how amazing it was she was on the throne?
Yeah.
Because I feel like she knew that, and that's one of the reasons that she was willing to do anything to keep her throne, because it had come at such a cost to her and continued to come at such a cost to her as she continued to defend it.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I really do. And I feel like she, by the time she became queen, she really felt like she'd earned that almost. For all that she'd been through, she had earned that, and she was going to keep hold of it at whatever cost. And I think that she had watched very carefully what Mary had done before her. And I think that that worked out to Elizabeth's advantage, I have to say. I think being the younger of the two sisters definitely worked in her favor in that respect. And she was able to almost kind of pick and choose the bits that Mary had done well. Okay, that worked well. Oh no, marrying a foreigner, not so good. So I think, yeah, she definitely learned some important lessons from that. And definitely, I think she appreciated it all the more because of all that she had been through to get to that point, and the fact that it could so easily have worked out differently in so many different respects.
Right. So many different times. And what it must have been like, and she mentions this, to be at the Tower right before her coronation and thinking not only of her previous time there, but her mother doing it sort of the opposite way. So her mother came first as queen and then as a prisoner. And she mentions that, you know, now she was there first as a prisoner and now as a queen. So it's just really interesting, that whole circle coming to, you know, a full close. So if you could, as a final question, if you could ask Elizabeth one question, what would it be?
Oh gosh, that's so difficult. I would like, okay, probably the $1 million question, but I would like to know how and when she discovered her mother's fate.
Okay. That's great. Yes. Because that probably had an influence on her that we can't even imagine. On some of her decisions. Okay. That's great. Well, thank you so much. This has been such a treat. I hate it to come to an end, but thank you so much. So we have this brilliant new book in addition to all of the others, but I can't let you leave without asking what you're working on now. So I know some of it. So Nicola is part of the Tudor Trio, who is continuing to have some wonderful ongoing programs. And I did see something in social media about something with Matt Lewis coming up. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yes. So we have just, it's mostly Matt actually, but Matt's just been creating a new documentary about Richard III. And I had a very small part to play in it, talking about Margaret Beaufort. So that's very exciting.
Okay. Oh, so, okay. So that's happening. And tell us, are there other things you're able to talk to us about that you have going on?
Genuinely, I haven't got a new book on the horizon just yet, because I feel like this has taken 4 years of my life and I really want to enjoy talking about it and sharing it. So I haven't started anything else yet. And I don't know when I will be doing anything else. So I'm just trying to think. I probably haven't. Yeah. I mean, hopefully you will see that there are lots of things coming up for young Elizabeth, lots more talks and online talks and things like that. Lots coming up with the Tudor Trio. And yeah, watch this space. Watch this space.
Okay. So we will have all those links in the show notes. Is it best? Well, we will have the Tutor Trio links and your own links. So we'll have all that in there so we can follow you everywhere. Thank you so much. I've just been so looking forward to this. One of my favorite historians, you know, I'm very effusive about people. And I have just loved this conversation. And also, I have to say, one of my favorite queens and figures in history, as well as I just can't stop thinking about Margaret Beaufort. And I see Margaret and Elizabeth as the bookends of that dynasty. And I can't help but think that some of that backbone and you do what you have to do to survive comes directly from Margaret Beaufort. I just can't see it coming. And Anne Boleyn as well. But I just see a lot of Margaret in Elizabeth. And
there's a lot. There is a lot. Yeah, there is a lot of great grandmother Tudor there for sure.
I think so. And
I'm sure Elizabeth would have been raised being told just how formidable her great grandmother was.
Right. And Margaret's importance to the dynasty. So I think there's a lot there. So, well, thank you so much for being here. And thank you everyone for listening. I know it's been a treat for you as it has for me. And please listen again, share with a friend. And thank you again, Nicola. We'll keep a watch on what's happening with you. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us for this special bonus episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics for Women's History Month, featuring Dr. Nicola Tallis. And thank you, Nicola, for joining us and sharing your book, Young Elizabeth. A big shout out and thank you to my patrons who make all of this possible, and to all of you for joining me. Thank you for being on this journey with me as we shake up history together. Thank you.